session number 24654, Reel 11.
We were just talking, Jack, about what would have happened to you if you had, you feel that a sympathetic view would have been taken?
No, I don't think so, really. I don't think I would dare. No, I think I'd have ended up court-martialed. But I wouldn't have budged me. No way.
You'd have had to have left the army.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I wouldn't have been imprisoned or anything. I'd have been either probably dismissed the service. And that would have been that. Yeah.
And you said there were a number of such instances.
Oh, there were a lot of, no, not like me, but I mean, there were a lot of executions.
Yes.
But, I mean, most of the executions were carried out by hanging and civil ones. I mean, one met. I personally didn't, but, I mean, Pierpoint was a well-known resident of some of our messes from time to time. He'd be in Hanover mess, you know. Execution in Hamelin prison for a number of war criminals. Oh dear, oh dear. Appalling. I know I'm talking about war criminals, but.
And you still feel that even war criminals should not be executed?
No, I don't agree with execution. Never will.
If Hitler had been taken alive, would you have executed him?
No, I think the best thing we could have done was even kept him alive. I think that would have been his biggest punishment. If he was going to, as he committed suicide, he probably would welcome execution, wouldn't he? Oh no, I think. I don't care what they are.
Right.
I don't think you can compromise. You either believe it or you don't. And I think, I mean, dreadful what's happened in America, but still.
So, if you'd like to touch on any points of the final part of your military career that you would like to mention. We've got to 1953.
Well, I can go over it very quickly, I think, because of it's not directly relevant to World War II in any way. But, I mean, it touches a bit on what we're doing. Because of my involvement, I decided in 1953 that I would go and read for the bar and wouldn't... at the end of my 5 years short service commission, I'd read for the bar, and I really started reading for the bar, frankly, before I left the army. But during the course of that, I meanwhile had been promoted to a major, and I was a fairly young major, really, by peacetime standards, and I was a intelligence staff. I got very much involved in what was NATO, Northern Army Group, part of it. In fact, I was in charge of a NATO intelligence cell, and I had Dutch officers and Belgian officers and that working with me, and American. So I became very much involved in the system. So I decided I'd stay in the army if I could. I'd stay in the army. And so I converted my commission to what was called an extended service commission, which is take me up to 20 years service. And in fact, I was probably the first extended service commission officer in the army. I had a few senior officer friends, in a sense, you know, my bosses who were. I got on well with, and they pushed it, and I was very rapidly given one of these extended service commissions. And then subsequently the intelligence corps could not at that time have regular officers, full-time permanent regular officers, because there was always something at the back of their mind was they didn't really need the intelligence corps. If they can get rid of it, they'll get rid of it. And any idiot can do that job, and we don't need the intelligence corps. And our most senior officer at anywhere was a lieutenant colonel. He was in fact the military attaché in Tokyo. But because we didn't have there was an attitude, but some of us didn't actually agree with that view, including anybody that's been directly involved in intelligence. At the top level, and we had quite a lot of support by some senior officers about making the corps a permanent corps of the army, because it had never been so. I mean, after World War, after the Boer War had broken up, after World War One it was broken up, and after World War Two they would like to have broken it up, because I mean, all these little jobs that were held by intelligence corps officers and potential senior officers, they wanted quotes for themselves, those who were making decisions. Well, in the end we won the argument and we made a permanent corps, and as soon as we were made a permanent corps, we created the first 100 permanent regular officers. Now most of those were people that transferred from other arms to become the permanent corps of the army, of the corps, but a high proportion, about 30 or 40% of them, were existing intelligence corps officers, and I was one of them. And that's how I then became permanent commission. There were about, of the 100, there were about 60 of us still left. It's a little club almost. And of course since then, I mean, we've gone on from strength to strength, and I mean, never mind about lieutenant colonels, and we have 3 major generals. And I mean, it's the world has changed so dramatically, completely. And now we are the only corps of the British Army which is permanently expanding. It's still expanding.
Is it?
Oh yeah, we've enlarged by a third in the last 2 years because of the demand for intelligence. And most of us, and one of the advantages of being in the intelligence corps, you're virtually operational the whole time.
And so this, you're permanently operational whilst you're a member of the corps.
Yeah, you're almost only doing an operational job somewhere.
And this modern military intelligence supplements the civilian intelligence services? Or
yeah, you're working always closely with MI5 and MI6 and you're also providing all what used to be called battlefield intelligence. I mean, you're doing the operational side of intelligence as well as the security and collection side of intelligence as well. So, which we're particularly strong in. I mean, all the intelligence backup now in Iraq and that is done by my corps.
I was about to ask then, so the assessment of the Iraqi military situation and their position prior to March and prior to the commencement of the war, the Second War, would have been done by your successors?
No, not quite. We're only responsible for military intelligence side of it.
That's what I meant.
Oh yes, yes, and the collection
Iraqi
of it.
Military situation.
Yeah, well it would be, well, it's a mixture. It's also done by staff officers who are intelligence staff officers who are seconded to intelligence, having been to staff colleges, we do, of course, as well, and do intelligence appointments. And I mean, we've never had an intelligence corps officer, for example, say, at the top of intelligence in the MOD. One day we might. I'm not certain that would be advisable anyway. I mean, I do think you want people that have almost, you know, have been commanding large military formations and understand, you know, the military operations side of it. But you want them at the most senior levels, and that's now happening. We've had intelligence officers. We've got one at the moment who is a chief of staff. Nothing to do with intelligence. And I've done non-intelligence appointments. I mean, one of the best jobs I ever did was a non-intelligence appointment when I was staff.
Which was?
I was what was called the Deputy Assistant Adjutant Quartermaster General of Yorkshire District. And I find I was concerned, one of the best jobs I ever did. I mean, there I was, a strange intelligence corps officer responsible for vehicle maintenance and REME and ordnance and doctors and all sorts of people. And they said, oh, this strange chap in the intelligence corps, what's he doing that for? But I was I'm a trained staff officer, and I was able to do it. So, and I did a 2-year staff job there.
When was this, Jack?
That was in 61, 63. Yeah. And I went from there to left-hand colonel.
And what were your final appointments as a left-hand colonel?
What would we call Corps Lieutenant Colonel, which is a system we adopted from the Brigade of Guards. They have regimental colonels. So we have a Corps Lieutenant Colonel, which is virtually the regimental head of the Corps. So you're responsible for postings of officers and and other ranks and Corps discipline, Corps organisation. You're virtually number two to the director of the Corps. You're number two, regimentally, and that was a good job. That was a very powerful position to be in, and you travelled the world. You went in all the units all over the world, which I did.
All the units of the
intelligence corps, yeah.
And where were this is pre-Suez, pre.
I meant pre
withdrawal from east of Suez, pre the Wilson government withdrawal from east of Suez.
Yeah, it was a. It was about that time. I mean, I was called Lieutenant Colonel in 68, 69.
Ah, so it would have been exactly contemporary.
Yeah, it was. Yes.
Where did you travel the world then? As we were.
Well, far east. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
So whilst we were withdrawing, the intelligence corps remained.
Oh yeah. Well, we had. We still had military units there. So it was a Far East, Hong Kong, United States, you name it, we were there. And in fact, as a corps, of course, we are the most deployed corps in the British Army. That's when I think we say something like, we're in 47 countries, something like that, because we're many of the military attachés of intelligence corps, or their staffs, or intelligence corps NCOs. So in Warsaw, Moscow, a lot. So it's one of the advantages, and of course our soldiers that we recruit have to have two A-levels as a private soldier.
Yes, even today.
Even today, we get them. We can't. They're lining up to join. We don't have to worry about joining. You know, anybody we want, and it's the same with officers from Sandhurst. I mean, when we got our officers from Sandhurst, when we first took our first regular officer from Sandhurst, the young sailor, and I go down and interview them, and you get, you know, three or four people that wanted to be in, join the corps, and the staff of the academy would be saying, "Well, they want intelligence corps. Why can't they go to the Third Carbineers or whatever, you know, whatever it was?" But they did. The corps that has the most applicants now at Sandhurst intelligence corps. We take about 6 and we get about 100 want to become. And of course we have a lot of women now as well.
Is the modern intelligence corps disproportionately represented by women compared to other?
No, but I think the chances of advancement are higher in our corps than, I won't say every other corps, perhaps the medical corps might be equally very, very good. But the chance of advancement seems to be very, very good. I mean, we've had two at Chicksands, where our intelligence centre is now. In fact, I'll be there tomorrow. The RSM of Chicksands, the RSM of the corps, that is, both of them have been women. Now, the last one has just been commissioned. The next one almost certainly will be. The next director of the intelligence corps is likely to be a woman. Next director, brigadier.
It suggests to me that this particular line of work lends itself to being done by women, not necessarily better than men, but better than other opportunities within the army for women.
Well, I suppose a factor in it. A, it requires brain power, not physical power.
Yes.
So that's a factor. I have not enough experience of women, because in my day there were fewer of them. There were sort of junior officer level, and they weren't intelligence corps in those days. They were ATS or WRAC, who were seconded to us permanently. So they were never, they never served with WRSC, they all served with us, but they were badged WRSC and subject to WRSC, you know, the Queen Bee at the top, sort of dictating a bit how they behaved or whatever. Well, now, of course, they're nothing to do with the WRSC, there's no such thing as a WRSC, it's been disbanded. And they all belong to the various arms for which they normally serve. So, I've not had that experience. I mean, whether they bring any feminine quality into it that we don't have, I don't know.
Now, Jack, we're coming towards the end. So we're coming towards the end of both our time this morning and your military career. So if there are any points that you'd like to end on, perhaps you'd like to mention them now.
Yeah. Well, it is part of my military career, which we haven't touched upon, and I'll just very briefly mention it. That I spent a long time in the Far East and tied in with the whole machinery of intelligence procurement and that, and in particular the function of the Joint Intelligence Committee and so on, for whom I worked and write an assessment for. And in particular, I then went out to the Far East to the Joint Intelligence Committee there to write assessments there. So I've seen the whole machinery of government, I mean from Prime Minister downwards, and the cabinet, and the way cabinet papers are produced, and so on. So I've written some of these, among other things. And all that's happened in these last few years is no different. And all the rubbish I've been hearing about Iraq and the way all these things are done is a load of rubbish, because that's not the way things function. I know it now because I have colleagues, former colleagues, who are still there. I can talk to them. I'll be seeing one or two of them probably tomorrow when I'm at Chicksands. So I know, you know, there is no difference in the way the system operates. So that's one thing. But go back a long way. And I mentioned the refugees coming down that road. And I saw the same in Normandy and so on. And slaughter. And the Falaise massacre that took place. I became a convert to the idea of Europe on those beaches of Normandy, frankly. And I remain so. Because I wasn't convinced then, on reflection, that this must never happen again. Whatever happens, it must never happen again. So I see the conflicts that can easily develop, because you can see it in the attitudes of the current press and the way people react to what's going on about Europe and so on, in a way which is very little different to what they would have reacted in 1938. I find that depressing, but it mustn't happen. Because soldiers are not people that want wars. We're the last people that want wars. And there are too many people who are willingly drive us into those situations. They won't have any responsibility for fighting them, or probably living with the consequences of them. So to my mind, the last thing you want to do is go to war for anything, if you can possibly avoid it. That doesn't mean to say that I think that the decision made for Iraq, for example, was the wrong one. I think it was the right one. But because I think it would prevent something bigger. And if we'd have done the same in the Rhineland, when the Germans marched into the Rhineland and so on, we may never have had World War II. But we didn't. A quiet reflection.
Thank you, Jack. And thank you for your contributions over these two lengthy sessions. You've been a stalwart contributor. Thank you so much for making this contribution to the Sound Archive at the Imperial War Museum.
Thank you.